Perhaps before we get involved in those activities, you might talk a little bit about your teaching and perhaps the relationship between your teaching and some of those activities we've already discussed.
Yes. I think I would say that my teaching experience in the law school, as I've indicated earlier, in rather summary form, was the relatively routine offering of courses in the basic law curriculum. However, there was a degree of concentration in the property area, which to some extent led to broader interests and more applied interests in the area of land use controls, regional planning, and environmental policy and environmental law. I taught from time to time the basic personal property course, but more importantly, the real property course, dealing with lands and land transactions, I found exciting. And I think we offered, or my offerings were respectable. And I, as I suggest, because of the role of land in the economy, the role of land in the Western development of the United States, the role of land as the basic resource with which we're dealing in environmental terms, all of this was intellectually a useful background for the more applied work further down the road. I also taught several times a water resources course, a water law course, and we put together in those late years of the late 60s and early 70s rather special courses concentrating on environmental policy and environmental law. But of course, the underpinnings in those areas go back to fundamental concepts of real property. And I think that if one wants to appreciate significant trends and developments in land use in the United States, one has to appreciate the roots of real estate and real property law as we brought them to this country from England. Now, I'm trying to recall, well, of course, and from time to time I was involved in the most practical side of the law school curriculum, in the summer program of teaching senior law students the elements of practice, which was sometimes done, or is done, in lieu of office internships that law students in the olden days took as a matter of course, but we now offer some of this within the law curriculum itself.
What was the advantage of doing this and instead of the internships?
Well, a good internship in which you have a law student entering a well-rounded firm and a senior member of that firm willing to give the time to his apprentice training, of course, cannot be replicated in the classroom.
However, it is difficult to find internships of that breadth and intensity in the day and age of specialization. So that while you may have a senior partner that is very dedicated to the student interest, if his own practice is highly specialized, in a short internship, you tend to get a cut of the practice, but you don't get the breadth that you think that a young lawyer should have going into any practice situation.
So this seminar would tend to give him skills in a variety of legal situations.
Yes. I would also say that I taught from time to time the Law and Society course, which had been put together originally by Lloyd Garrison and Lord Hurst. And it was an effort to introduce the beginning law student to the role of the law in societal affairs, just as the name suggests. The case, the carrying example, was the workman's compensation legislation in Wisconsin, which was the most interesting historical development, really copied after Bismarckian social security legislation in Germany. Milwaukee industrialists and Wisconsin governmental leaders studied that system in Germany, along with John R. Commons and his associates, and eventually passed, and the first such law in the United States, workman's compensation legislation in the early 1900s, I think 1910 or 1911. Well, that course was not about the intricacies of workman's compensation. That was the carrying example. And then it was carried through from its inception, or its conceptual development, through the legislative process and through the early tests in the Wisconsin courts. I always thought it was a very exciting course, but this in part because of my interest in the public law and my broader interest in government and public policy and public administration. But nonetheless, in that law school teaching, there were the roots of what I did in the last phase of my active career. And I was influenced certainly by Hurst, and more particularly by Jacob Boischer, who I think I mentioned very early on in all this when I was talking about Boischer's father, who would try lawsuits in German in my great uncle's court in Milwaukee.
That's right, you did say that.
But Boischer was a remarkable lawyer and a remarkable person who showed great growth himself over his career and became the law school's authority, particularly in water law and in land use law, and in turn applied his knowledge in the state's interest. For example, it was Boischer, the lawyer, and Jerry Rolick, the water scientist, that did the fundamental work in the mid-1960s in Wisconsin's pioneering water quality and water resource planning legislation. But I tired somewhat, I think, of the traditional law school teaching format. Despite the interest that I had in the substance of it all. And so this really does lay the background for this departure into new institutional or new educational structure and the applied professional activity or work of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning and the Center for Public Policy and Public Administration.
Well, I'd like you to go into how this change evolved.
Well, it, like most of these things, they're more accident than design. The planning department, which is a fully constituted academic department in the College of Letters and Science, had run as a committee degree program, really, for some time in the 60s, roughly through the early part of the 60s, with people like Boischer from the law school, Ray Penn from agricultural economics, Clarenbach from political science, and others, constituting the faculty committee, the board of control, and the teaching faculty, and using courses, established courses, where they fit, in broadly throughout the social studies departments, and to some extent in engineering, the engineering side being survey and some urban design courses and that sort of thing. But it became a full-fledged department, at least in terms of the rules, somewhat later on, and they continued to have people like Boischer until his death as associate faculty members, but they built a permanent faculty. And included in that group was Coleman Woodbury, a very distinguished American planner, who was brought to the university as a research professor. But it had not alone growing pains, but constraints. Given the size of a relatively small student body, the fact that it taught only a limited number of introductory undergraduate courses, all of which led to a to difficulty of maintaining the program and problems with personnel and keep people going on leave and there being a gap in courses, differences within within the faculty group, differences as to what the approach should be in this quasi-academic, quasi-professional program. And it resulted in a mini-crisis within the department and concern on the part of the dean, who was then Steve Klaney, the mathematician, and the chancellor as to whether this effort was worth carrying on or whether it should be abandoned or folded into other elements of the university. Well, I fail to mention that the key addition to the department was Irving Fox, the political scientist, environmentalist, who came from Resources for the Future to join that faculty, as well as being, in part, in being associate director of the Water Resources Research Center with Rolick, Jerry Rolick, who Gerard Rolick, who is now about to retire, I think, doing his final years at the University of Texas. Mm. Where he's associated with the LTJ school, as well as the Department of Engineering, the College of Engineering. Well, the intellectual differences within that small faculty grew into personal differences, And something had to be done to either salvage the effort or abandon it or split it up. And it was at that juncture that the members of the planning faculty, and I knew most of them, came to me and suggested to the dean, the chancellor, that to the extent that I carried any of the credentials of a lawyer like Boischer, who was interested in land use matters and public programs and public policy, raising the question whether I would come down to be the chair of the department. And that's how it happened. It was by invitation internally within the faculty. I was not superimposed. And the acquiescence, and more than that, the strong support of Claney and Young.
Well, now, before you became chairman, had you been sort of officially involved in this
at
all?
No, I hadn't been an associate member. I didn't have that status. But my interests were well enough known, and after all, one can't serve in government at the level that I did, nor be the director of the planning coordinating body for all of higher education in the state without, in effect, being involved in the planning domain.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, the planning faculty, while it's different than other institutions, is really an interdisciplinary, really a multidisciplinary grouping. There's a good question as to whether planning is an academic discipline in the traditional sense or not. I rather think it is not.
But it draws on disciplines.
But it draws on disciplines and must array and coordinate and integrate those disciplines into a reasonable sort of futurism, short-term usually, but laying the base for future actions and activities, be it the physical side, or whether it's a planning of essentially social programs, or a mix. So, without formal qualification, but rather informal qualification and experience, and coming out of one of the disciplines that is involved, that was the basis for for my appointment. And I welcome all of this because I happen to think in more in applied terms than limited scholarly terms, and enjoy the experience of working with several related disciplines towards a common objective.
What, after you became chairman, what direction, if there was one, did the department's activities take?
Well, I don't think that there was any marked departure from what we'd been attempting to do. More was the effort to effectively integrate the people that we had on the faculty and to offer a degree of leadership that would bring these people working in closer harmony. So that there was not profound intellectual or academic departure. It was more a tidying up effort of doing what we had, or what they had been attempting to do. And then in addition to that, the internal administration of the unit, I was involved with Governor Lucy's land use study group, which was chaired by his predecessor, Warren Knowles, and conducted, in addition to participating in the staff work of all of that, conducting an interdisciplinary year-long seminar, which was actually supported out of the new IES program. So I really had a hand, limited part, the back of hands, limited part back to the law school, urban and regional planning, and was involved with the emerging Institute for Environmental Studies. Unfortunately, two of our very best people in this broad mix left at about that time. Fox went to the University of British Columbia, where he still is. And Rolick went to Texas, the University of Texas at Austin. Bryson, Reed Bryson, the meteorologist, became the director of the new Institute for Environmental Studies, and I was designated by the chancellor as one of the permanent faculty members of that institute. The organization of the institute is, I think, too complex to go into here, and that can be obtained from other sources. But from my side, I was active in it as a permanent part of the faculty and served on the executive committee and so on from that point forward until I left, until I retired.
Could you say something about what led up to the formation of the Institute for Environmental Studies?
Yes. We have, of course, had in the 60s a variety of interdisciplinary groupings. There was the urban regional planning effort, there was the water resource management effort. These are instructional programs. We became one of the first participating universities in the National Sea Grant Program, which is research rather than instruction. We had the Water Resources Research Center. There was the variety of activity stemming out of the College of Agriculture with people like Ray Penn and Phil Lewis over landscape architecture. A rather complete range of interdisciplinary instruction and research pointed to the environmental sector. Now, then came the question, well, are we content with this as it stands, or do we want an umbrella kind of organization that would relate to or encompass some of what we had and to add other programs, both degree programs and broadened research activity. There was a faculty committee that developed all of this and eventually approved to do just that, to have this kind of umbrella organization. I suppose therein lies the seeds of controversy over the next decade, because you had a somewhat different philosophy on the part of the leaders concerned.
Can you specify?
Yes. I think that Reed, Bryson, and very much centered in Reed, who is the director of the effort, once having accomplished and having gotten the structure, tended to think in terms of that umbrella unit as the operating unit, and with less and less concern for the participating elements. In a university as complex as ours, and as distinguished and as proud and within its departments and within its other programs, we really, our faculty doesn't accept a degree of central coordination or control that a tight organizational model would suggest. And so you had complications with the College of Agriculture as between Reed and then very powerful dean Glenn Pound. As I said, Fox and Rolick had departed. There was the Water Resources Center did not become fully affiliated with or the program to the extent that the Sea Grant program did.
That's curious to me.
Yes, though of course they all have their own charters. I'm trying to think of other elements. For example, the Limnological Laboratory, Arthur Hassler's operation, stayed wholly independent, though its senior faculty were participating members in the Institute's program. So it was a mixed bag of success. The research program, monies were available, both governmental and foundation, and the Institute's research efforts got off to good start with good support. On the instructional side, and this is where I suppose the conflict and the resistance became most critical. In that area, we had joint appointments and so on and so forth, and very good people. And as I said, I was one of the permanent professors. I think John Steinhardt was. I'm trying to think who else. I can't really remember at the moment. But the instructional program was in effect limited, both by design and by virtue of outside pressures, to sort of supplementary coursework, duly approved by the division committee and so on, but they were courses offered as electives. And there, though the founding authority of the Institute allowed for both undergraduate and graduate degree programs, this was not accomplished, and still has not been accomplished. So, what the Institute has is three graduate programs that have governing executive committees appointed by the dean of the graduate school, but are administratively under IES.
What are these three?
Well, it's the Water Resource Management Program, the Land Resources Program, which have been
generated principally in the College of Agriculture, and that program has both a master's level and a PhD, but it operates under its own academic executive committee, but is administered and therefore influenced, of course, by IES. And the third is the remote sensing program, which was really generated in engineering. And has, again, some very talented people involved on joint appointment, IES and College of Engineering. But it too, like the other two, has its own administrative, or its own executive committee. Now, none of this troubles me very much because the programs are working well, and we're training first-rate people who are in demand all around the country in all three of these programs. But they're hybrid. Now, in retrospect, this is more often than not the way we do things on the Madison campus. And the organizational niceties of this never troubled me very much, as long as the programs were good,
mm-hmm.
and the students were receiving a quality training. And by keeping them hybrid, there's always room for an interested faculty member, regardless of what his formal affiliations may be, to participate.
Yes, that is an affiliation.
And this, of course, is one of our strengths. We have this great faculty in every imaginable discipline. But when we can draw from within those ranks and bring together a critical mass of talented faculty against an agreed-upon objective, we're bringing to the student the coordinated resources of one of the best faculties in the world. And that's why our graduate students, who again are very concerned about organizational nicety, appreciate this kind of multidisciplinary effort, and which moves to the interdisciplinary in research areas, or interdisciplinary in terms of a mixed discipline team, let's say on a PhD committee. Well, the undergraduate program was resisted, especially by the College of Letters and Science. And in fact, under a report done by the chairman of sociology, it was rejected. What I did, so I might as well move to that part of the story.
Yes, I'm interested in why.
The last 3 years, I guess, that I was active, I was elected the chairman of the instructional program of IES. Now, this is an action by Reed and by the IES Executive Committee. And I followed Grant Cobb, a very able botanist who had exercised that role for several years and had gone through the frustrations of attempting to achieve authority for a freestanding undergraduate degree, which did not succeed. Well, I thought that discretion was the better part of valor in all of this, and that the objective should be a program that would bring together in a coherent way a series of environmentally oriented courses that a student could take as a supplement to his basic disciplinary major. And that's what we did. And we now have
a certificate program in which IES offers some of its own faculty, some retained faculty or arranged faculty, a series of courses, and I think it's 20 some credits, which a student may elect to take over and above his disciplinary major. So you have zoologists, political scientists, sociologists, geographers, so forth, and they're all, you know, letters and science students and managed by letters and science and so on, except that the Institute offers this integrated, organized set of courses that, when completed, gives the student a certificate of accomplishment in environmental studies in addition to his disciplinary degree. Students seem to like it. You don't, obviously, you don't get volunteers for this degree of, for this amount of added work that are not ambitious and hardworking. Now, mind you, this isn't 120 credits for a Bachelor of Science degree in a college, plus it is possible to accomplish all this by using, you see, electives, options.
Which would not increase the total number of credits required?
No, not necessarily, though typically I think the students in the certificate program do. In other words, they'll probably end up with 130 credits or something like that. And that seems to have worked quite well, and it has achieved a level of confidence and support in the several colleges that we were, I thought, in danger of losing by attempting head-on competition.
What?
The PhD program has never been approved. We did some work on it when I was there. Henry Hart, who succeeded me, the political scientist, as chairman of that instructional program, has continued the effort. What shape and form that will eventually take, I'm not sure, though I happen to think that a vehicle for the PhD program in this general area is worthy. Provided the basic condition is met, namely the participation on a multidisciplinary basis of key people from the several appropriate disciplines. I would like to see a program at the PhD level, and a very rigorous one, in which there are three principal components. And how we reach this organizationally has not yet been resolved, but I would say that the student in that sort of PhD program should have a strong disciplinary training in whatever discipline it may be, at least through the master's level. But one has to be very careful in designing broader academic programs that, in the effort to achieve breadth, that you lose depth.
Mm.
So that we want the students to have substantial depth in any discipline, be it social studies or be it science. And then in the PhD program, that they cross over, if you please, and they make up deficiencies in the counter set of departments. For example, an economist ought to learn the basic elements of the natural sciences. The scientist should learn the basic elements of the social studies. Then gluing it together is a common training in quantitative methodology,
mm-hmm.
which is extremely important in this day and age, and is also not just for its intellectual rigor, but rather that it allows, when being applied, to interrelate through a common language the science and the social science. And then, of course, this is capped off by a dissertation that is broad, rigorous, and has a substantial policy thrust. I think the kind of person I'm talking about to achieve that kind of degree is probably not going to be a traditional academic person, but rather is a person that would either do the comparable sort of thing in an academic institution, but more particularly may serve industry, the government, or the government, or somewhere in other parts of the commercial world, as really high-level analysts, planners, and policy formulators. So that rather than a degree that would be in any way cheapened by superficial breadth, this kind of degree, as I see it, would be really very genuine, legitimate, a doctor of philosophy degree with disciplinary depth, cross-exchange, the rigor of the common quantitative methodological language, and a dissertation, a piece of research work that represents all of that and the policy thrust related to the subject area.
Which sounds to me like a plan for a very substantial degree.
Yes, and it would be expensive. I mean, I think the student, I think that the ordinary student would probably spend at least 4 years achieving this degree, if 3 years is the norm for others, because of the requirements that you build in.
Because of a certain breadth that would be involved.
Yeah. But, and I say all this because my governmental experience
suggests they are so complex
and so many elements involved that mere specialist training is not enough. It may be enough at some lower level, but as you get higher up on the policy making, decision making tree, one has to have, I suggest, the kind of breadth that this sort of degree would provide. The lawyer in American society, of course, used to play this role before we trained public administrators or policy analysts or environmentalists and so on, because the lawyer's ability to integrate subject area and process made him, for better or for worse, what the candidates for policy formulation and decision making up this tree that I referred to. But I think that time is probably past because the subject matter has become so sophisticated and complex that one can't simply pick it up quickly enough, or enough of it quickly enough, to become involved in a decision about how to handle the disposal of waste in a major metropolitan area like Milwaukee or Chicago. Now, there's so much science and engineering involved in all of that that there has to be in a person's early academic training, if not absolute knowledge, the appreciation of the scientific elements in order to function most effectively.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the coin, mere training in the water-related sciences or water-related engineering is not enough, because these decisions are being made and the programs are being developed in the context of complex federalism, and that person whose basic training is in the sciences or technology must have himself a fundamental appreciation of the institutions that he's dealing with. Because without that, the technical person either is simply so lost that he loses effectiveness, or so dependent on another set of disciplines as to diminish his potential contribution. So I guess that's my case for the value of genuine multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary preparation for the leadership element in a complex 20th century society. And I use the IES PhD program as a carrying case for the argument.
Well, it does seem to me you make it pretty clear why this kind of training is important.
And given the fact that the University of Wisconsin not alone has its distinction in the discipline, but because we have always attempted to keep the university abreast of the world's affairs and problems and ways and means of meeting them, this is why it excites me to think that, that some genuine pioneering academic work could be done on the Madison campus. Because we have all of the elements, really. We have the faculty strength, our rules tend to allow what I call the sort of hybrid academic programs in terms of organizational style. And I would like to think that the spirit and the philosophy is still there, that it has made the Madison campus truly one of the intellectual academic giants that it has become.
Well, one way. Hope that this could be done. What are the obstacles that you see to such a program at the present time?
I think at the moment, money, of course, is a constraint. Because the kind of program I'm talking about, at least to use this PhD program, would require competitive and long-term fellowships. There's another claimant for limited graduate student support. Ignorance and disinterest on the part of the national government in this sort of sophisticated training for coping with the problems of our age. The thinking there tends to be that you could just get back to the good old days, that the problems would disappear and that you don't really have to face them at all.
That's so exciting.
Yes. There are always problems internally within the faculties, those who would simply disagree with the philosophy or say that there is simply no substitute for the classical German Hopkins mold of training of a PhD, which is intensive specialization period. But I don't really think that's the obstacle. I think it's probably money, lack of outside support I'm not sure there's an absolute lack, but it would probably have to be private foundation money that would be needed to launch this sort of thing. In lieu of the U.S. government. And honestly, imagination on the part of university leadership.
Feel this imagination is lacking at the moment?
Well, I wouldn't want to make that charge because if I did, it would suggest that this is all sort of vacuous and pipe dreams on the part of the field. However, university administration can do only so much at one time.
Mm.
If you're concentrating, or if you are forced to concentrate on financial management, the most rigorous kind, because the resources aren't available, which I think has been Irving Shane's problem since he took over as chancellor. Every year there are further cuts in support.
Yes, that is.
The opportunity to be imaginative and to give impetus and leadership to new program activity is damn difficult when you're trying to figure out how you're going to pay the faculty that you already have. In the baldest terms. And so I have the greatest sympathy with the Shanes of the piece and the several deans. They just don't have the luxury that Fred Harrington and earlier chancellors or deans like our friend Leon Epstein had when money was relatively available, both from the state and from the outside. Nonetheless, I would hope that despite these formidable obstacles, just in terms of keeping the place afloat, that enough time, enough effort could be set aside that we not become, in effect, mired in our own administrative complexities and many of them not of our own making, particularly on the money side of it all, and that we not, so that we continue to be imaginative and generators of intellectual program that is so desperately needed in terms of having people that can cope with the problems of our age.
It does seem a little strange that perhaps not strange, that those responsible for our national government don't realize this more than they seem to.
Yes, it is. It is almost tragic. I guess it isn't tragic until we suffer further reverses of a social economic nature. But unfortunately, the bureaucracy is sort of treading water. The Congress is in disrepute, and it has lost, I think, much of its stability and internal cohesion. And while as one gets older, one always looks back to golden days, and you look back to the golden days and you look forward with doom and pessimism. I guess I don't see, for example, Sam Rayburn in the House of Representatives at the moment, or one could draw examples on the Senate side as well. And the leadership on the executive side, I find appalling. It's ideological, and it's set by their own definition somehow in the 1920s, in which Coolidge prosperity, which led to Hoover Depression, is somehow deemed to be the golden age of the United States.
Don't you find this a little surprising, this attitude?
Well, I don't find it surprising from the people who are in power.
Yes, of course.
I guess I find it surprising that we have come to this state and the state of affairs, and I think that that state of affairs was brought on by a degree of overconfidence and incompetence on the part of the preceding administration, so that and while all that smacks of partisanship, and in part it is, because as an old line Democrat, I think that the Democratic Party over a couple of hundred years has offered solid, imaginative leadership. We, on both sides of the aisle, and including the last Democratic administration, while the commitments were exciting, the concepts, and the concepts too, that we were unable to translate this very effectively into national policy and programs that were up to the standard of, were up to meeting and coping with the problem set.
Well, that seems to be pretty clear. There just hasn't been national policy that people could get hold of.
And, of course, this harks back to things we said earlier, that the American people like quick fixes. They have been used to frontiers that could be met and exploited. After all, it wasn't all American, quote, know-how and genius that put us where we are. We also happen to have to be located on a relatively isolated continent with tremendous resource base open to development and, unfortunately, exploitation. But we're running out.
That is one of the big problems. Well, we've been talking about public policy, really, about this Center for the Study of Public Policy and Administration.
I tried to roughly cover the IES situation. The other appointment that sort of rounded out my participation in interdisciplinary programs was the invitation to succeed Clara Penniman as the director of the Center for Public Policy and Administration. This program, I regret to say, was not really born within the university, but rather in state government. When Wayne McGowan was Secretary of Administration for Warren Knowles, this was conceived. And, of course, with the university's approval, some monies were set up to create this center, which had both instructional and potentially a research mission. The program offering, the degree offering, is a master's degree, and we've attracted good students, and they in turn, about half of them, have gone back into Wisconsin state government. Some to leave for other opportunities, and some to go into the state government, some to go to the federal government, some to local units of government. And the research program has never generated much support, although potentially it's there. But again, the strength of the operation is the fact that its executive committee and its faculty represents a multidisciplinary mix within the social studies. And it does not, unlike urban and regional planning, it does not have departmental stakes. So that the young assistant professor is appointed with his academic home, shall we say, in political science, young John Witte as an example, who is the grandson, by the way, of Edwin.
Oh.
Yale PhD, a Wisconsin undergraduate Yale PhD. But Witte is paid 50-50, half from the center and half from political science. The personnel management of Witte is essentially the responsibility of political science. His duties are split. And that's the pattern in the Institute. This, again, was by invitation on the part of the executive committee of the center, that I not forego or give up links with the other academic programs, but rather that I be the half-time director of the center. And I accepted this really with enthusiasm, because it provided an opportunity to relate planning to the center, to keep the IES linkage, keep the law school linkage, all to the end that we bring faculty resources to bear on these young people that wanted to be trained for a professional career in government.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in part by accident, obviously, but it is sort of the fulfillment of what I was all about in terms of being a member of the faculty. So it was a very, very happy circumstance. And we built up the enrollments, added first-rate faculty, and unfortunately also in the process of losing a few, like Matthew Holden, who chose not to return to the University of Wisconsin.
Oh.
And he finished at the Energy Regulatory Commission. I'm not sure that he did the right thing, but he did it. And faculty is departing for, I think, extended life or extended duties in Israel.
Who is that?
Karkansky. First grade scholar, teacher, Ira Karkansky. Clara Pellman will retire soon. I was obliged to retire. Bill Young will retire soon. So there will be some of a complete turnover in the senior faculty at the center. However, I think we are now, the center is well enough established with state government particularly, and reasonably well recognized within the university and administration, within the faculty of the administration, that it will in fact continue and prosper in the years to come. Helping all of this is not just our own local commitment, but the fact that people like Derek Curtis Bach, the president of Harvard, is convinced that the great gap in American professional training is this very area. And Bach has really given the intellectual leadership, and at Harvard, the action leadership with respect to the Kennedy School. Bach was dean of the law school, the chairman of the planning and executive committee that brought the Kennedy School to full flower.
I see.
And it's always been my maxim that if it's good enough for Harvard, it ought to be good enough for us at least to look at it really seriously.
Reasonable position.
As a matter of fact, more so, given the traditions and history of the University of Wisconsin and its training of and its service to both the state and national governments. Well, and we arranged a joint degree program with the law school, which is something that John Conway and I had always wanted to do. For our graduates, the law school reduces their graduation requirements and conversely on a proportional basis. We have 4 or 5 students a year pursuing that avenue. Then, looking at the future of all of that and what I wanted to accomplish, and it's very near accomplishment now, was to integrate urban and regional planning as a department and the Center for Public Policy and Administration and the graduate training program for foreign students. That Bill Young has led for the past 10 years, and Ed Young is now involved in, as the third element in his school, or his center, I don't really care what it's called, of public affairs. Now the mix is not easy because each has its own history and its own status. Bill Young's program uses our degree, we have a degree authority. Urban Regional Planning, on the other hand, is a full-fledged department. So it would be a rather another umbrella organization, but a relatively benign umbrella kind of organization, managing and giving some collective strength to these three programs involved in sense in the public sector, with a continuing appropriate linkages back into the disciplines with the business school, with the law school, IES, and other such activities. I think that's going to go. It isn't going to cost very much, and I think the chancellor and the Academic Planning Council and all these people are prepared to do this and to give it some pizzazz. and in due recognition, that we want to name this the Robert LaFollette School of Public Affairs.
Oh, I like that.
Here we have in our own ranks, our own graduate, our own political family, the person who really represented the application of intellect to public problems. And all we've done for LaFollette is to name one house in the dormitories for him. So what better? You see?
Yes, that's right.
If Minnesota can have the Humphrey School and Harvard the Kennedy School and Texas the Johnson School, why not go back to the real pioneer in this exercise, I say, of applying intellect to public problems and have a LaFollette School in Wisconsin?
I can't think of anything more appropriate.
So I think this is going to go, and I'm sorry that I didn't have the chance to see this all the way through, but I think it's going to happen. And I should, you know, be delighted when this all comes about.
How soon do you think this might develop?
Within the next year.
That soon? Yeah,
because the groundwork has been laid. And there are people in the legislature, unfortunately, one is Heinrich, who is leading, Tom Heinrich, but there are others. For example, the Florida Union Assembly, Tom Loftus, is one of our graduates.
I see.
But this helps.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that whoever may be elected governor, whether it's Tony Earle or Wood or Schreiber or the Republican, who's really an extension professor on Lee, you know, in trouble. Maybe you can plug their name in.
Yes, I can do that.
Roll Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I would think would be most agreeable to all of this. And if it comes about, it would be a very real leg up, both within the campus, or on the campus, and gaining some modest external recognition.
Would there be a degree program, a PhD?
I don't know. Well, it could be, of course, but planning has PhD authority now.
Yes.
I'm rather inclined to think that this area, or let's say that this IES degree is generated, and maybe it won't be only an IES degree. Maybe it'll come out of there the potential PhD program that kind of I talked about earlier, but have a broader base. It's conceivable that it could be the center, IES, and so on. Again, you form the appropriate organizing base, make it not just an IES program. Or on a PhD program, I have not honestly pushed for this because I thought that given the center's organizational format and participation by people jointly appointed, that the degree programs, the PhD programs, can continue simply be offered by political science, economics, sociology, the participating discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Taught in the first, when she was a graduate student in English, in the first integrated liberal studies effort. And Bob Pooley was...
He was head of it.
Head of it,
yes.
And the professor of English. And we had a distinguished group of interdisciplinarians who were working in that freshman-sophomore level program.
She came from essentially a southern background, Memphis, and other points in the south. She herself had grown up in the upper Midwest, but that was the family lineage and pattern. We had three children, Carlisle Ford, who was named for me and for his uncle, an able young surgeon who was killed in the war, and naval vessel off Okinawa. Elizabeth Marie's and Frederica. They've all now completed college, with Ford being the up and coming academic of the piece, through Chapel Hill and Rhodes Scholar of the college and Oxford. Then back to Wisconsin for his PhD in the Dan Bromley in agricultural economics, and now back to Chapel Hill as a faculty member in political science. The girls are seeking employment.
They got lots of company.
Yeah, which I hope will be successful soon. Elizabeth, their mother, died in 1964. It was a complex case of multiple sclerosis, or at least that was as close as the diagnosis could come, and then added complications and so on. I was remarried in 1966 to Eleanor Vilas, who had grown up in Madison, and her family was not of the distinguished William Freeman Vilas strain, but a set of distant relatives. Her mother, Madison family, the Johnson family, whose claim to fame was the development of the Eastern Company. Sally, this is known, has had two children by previous marriage. Michael, who is a graduate of the University of Colorado and the Wisconsin Law School, who is currently serving as a senior clerk out of the United States Court of Appeals on the West Coast. Served a year in San Francisco, and this year in Juneau, Alaska. That Ninth Circuit sweeps up all of the western states and Hawaii and Alaska.
Oh, my.
And then a daughter, Catherine, who is an equestrian of some talent and trains horses and gives instruction in dressage and all the elegant techniques of riding. So the family currently five children that I've identified. Now, I don't know if there's anything further on that score that is appropriate for this purpose.
Well, I guess we've covered the territory thoroughly, I hope.
I think we've probably exhausted the subject and bared most of which is appropriate for public scrutiny.
Well, am I correct in my feeling that looking back, that you enjoyed your years at the University of Wisconsin?
Oh, of course. I was never a great scholar. Maybe a fair teacher,
And it's sort of interesting, at least in my case, I think one becomes a better teacher over the years as one accumulates experience to relate to theoretical and book achieved knowledge. So in the latter years, which someone like Steve Bourne, who's been chief state planner and comes from a hard science background, a geologist, we offered over several years a joint course of introduction to regional planning. We enjoyed it. I think the students enjoyed it and gained a great deal from it. But it was the kind of teaching that one couldn't have done 20 years before that. We would have had the same, or much of the same, intellectual substance, but it couldn't have been offered with the confidence that experience brings to any an application brings to any theoretical construct. And I enjoyed my various administrative roles within the university, both for the sake of doing it and improving, and I would hope the subset that you were responsible for, or at one point in the coordinating committee, that was the entire post-high school educational effort for the state. That there was great satisfaction in that kind of service, and I was fortunate. And this is one of the things that the University of Wisconsin allows. They allow people very much to shape their own career patterns. If you want leave, you get leave. And so I was in and out of the university, and served, I think I said yesterday, at every level of government, from appointments at the local level to trying to serve the United Nations at the international level. So, again, when that experience comes back and is plowed back into the leadership of the program, like the graduate training in public policy and public administration, again, that combination of actual experience and a reasonable amount of theoretical training and exposure to multidisciplinary activities. This, of course, is what I found exciting. And there are not many, if any, academic institutions in the country that can afford that sort of career pattern. I may have, maybe it will not be true, or it can be true. Maybe we're under too tight financial strictures and tying people to rather specific assignments, and that I was around in an era, however, in which it was, for which I'm very fortunate. We have in UW-Madison, and UW-Madison is representative, I think, of the state. One of the most successful experiments in public higher education. Part due to the quality of the faculty, quality of the leadership over the years, and in part due to the quality of the body politic that has, if not understood with precision what we were about, sensed that we were about the right things, and over the years, until very recent years, have provided rather generously for a small state, relatively small state, to support the maintenance of the institution. So, on balance, it's all been a very positive and happy experience. There is one aspect of the Center for Public Policy and Public Administration that I failed earlier to develop. That is the commitment and the sub-organization within the center for delivering, to please university faculty talent, to problems of state government. We formed this up and call it the Office of Governmental Studies, a very slender staff, but we had some outside money, both Brittingham and Ford Foundation, to launch this effort. And it is nothing more nor less than a institutionalization of the Wisconsin idea. And we have a working group, university faculty, and the state government agency representatives that develop an agenda annually of critical areas in which the state needs help. And we in turn, on the university side, seek to obtain with adequate lead time faculty members and associated graduate students or senior research associates, faculty members who are prepared, willing, and of course able to address those problems. It, mind you, it is only one additional element in the whole chain of relationships that the university enjoys with state government and other organizations around the state. It's worked quite well, and as part of this major plan for the center, the school or center for public affairs, this would be put on a permanent basis and enough state money put under it so that it can continue to function. And it's just another example, an articulation of the traditional concept of the Madison campus, the Madison faculty supporting legitimate concerns of state government. And this goes back in our history, of course, to Van Hise, the geologist president of the university in the La Follette era and through World War I, and carried forward by men like John R. Commons, Ed Whitty, and others of our applied social scientists who over the years have provided the scholarly input that state issues deserve, but find difficult to obtain unless our own state university is prepared to provide them. So I thought that development was worthy of a particular note in the context of the Center for Public Policy.
Yes.
Done.
They are so complex.
And so many elements involved that mere specialist training is not enough. It may be enough at some lower level, but as you get higher up on the policy making, decision making tree, one has to have, I suggest, the kind of breadth that this sort of degree would provide. The lawyer in American society, of course,
used to play this role before we trained public administrators or policy analysts or environmentalists and so on, because the lawyer's ability to integrate subject area and process made him, for better or for worse, what the candidates for policy formulation and decision making up this tree that I referred to. But I think that time is probably past because the subject matter has become so sophisticated and complex that one can't simply pick it up quickly enough or enough of it quickly enough to become involved in a decision about how to handle the disposal of waste in a major metropolitan area like Milwaukee or Chicago. Now, there's so much science and engineering involved in all of that that there has to be in a person's early academic training, if not absolute knowledge, the appreciation of the scientific elements in order to function most effectively.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the coin, mere training in the water-related sciences or water-related engineering is not enough, because these decisions are being made and the programs are being developed in the context of complex federalism, and that person whose basic training is in the sciences or technology must have himself a fundamental appreciation of the institutions that he's dealing with. Because without that, the technical person either is simply so lost that he loses effectiveness, or so dependent on another set of disciplines as to diminish his potential contribution. So I guess that's my case for the value of genuine multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary preparation for the leadership element in a complex 20th century society. And I use the IES PhD program as a carrying case for the argument.
Well, it does seem to me you make it pretty clear why this kind of training is important.
And given the fact that the University of Wisconsin not alone has its distinction in the disciplines, but because we have always attempted to keep the university abreast of the world's affairs and problems and ways and means of meeting them, this is why it excites me to think that that some genuine pioneering academic work could be done on the Madison campus. Because we have all of the elements, really. We have the faculty strength. Our rules tend to allow what I call the sort of hybrid academic programs in terms of organizational style. And I would like to think that the spirit and the philosophy is still there, that it has made the Madison campus truly one of the intellectual academic giants that it has become.
Well, one would hope that this could be done. What are the obstacles that you see well, to such a program at the present time?
I think at the at the moment, money, of course, is a constraint, because the kind of program I'm talking about, at least to use this this PhD program, would require competitive and long-term fellowships. There's another claimant for limited graduate student support. Ignorance and disinterest on the part of the national government in this sort of sophisticated training for coping with the problems of our age. The thinking there tends to be that if you just get back to the good old days, that the problems would disappear and that you don't really have to face them at all.
I'm sure excited.
Yes. There are always problems internally within the faculties, those who simply disagree with the philosophy or say that there is simply no substitute for the classical German Hopkins mold of training for the PhD, which is intensive specialization period. But I don't really think that's the obstacle. I think it's probably money, lack of outside support I'm not sure there's an absolute lack, but it would probably have to be private foundation money that would be needed to launch this sort of thing. In lieu of the U.S. government, and honestly, imagination on the part of university leadership.
Feel this imagination is lacking at the moment?
Well, I wouldn't want to make that charge because if I did, it would suggest that this is all sort of vacuous and pipe dreams on the part of the fields. However, university administration can do only so much at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're concentrating, or if you are forced to concentrate on financial management, the most rigorous kind, because the resources aren't available, which I think has been Irving Chain's problem since he took over as chancellor. Every year there are further cuts in support.
Yes, that is the case.
The opportunity to be imaginative and to give impetus and leadership to new program activity is damn difficult when you're trying to figure out how you're going to pay the faculty that you already have. In the baldest terms. And so I have the greatest sympathy with the Shanes of the piece and the several Deans. They just don't have the luxury that Fred Harrington and earlier chancellors or deans like our friend Leon Epstein had when money was relatively available, both from the state and from the outside. Nonetheless, I would hope that despite these formidable obstacles, just in terms of keeping the place afloat, that enough time, enough effort could be set aside that we not become, in effect, mired in our own administrative complexities, and many of them not of our own making, particularly on the money side of it all, and so that we continue to be
imaginative and generators of intellectual program that is so desperately needed in terms of having people that can cope with the problems of our age.
It does seem a little strange that perhaps not strange, that those responsible for our national government don't realize this more than they seem to.
Yes, it is. It is almost tragic. I guess it isn't tragic, and don't we suffer further reverses of a social economic nature. But unfortunately, the bureaucracy is sort of treading water. The Congress is in disrepute, and it has lost, I think, much of its stability and internal cohesion. And while as one gets older, one always looks back to golden days, and you look back to the golden days and you look forward with doom and pessimism. I guess I don't see, for example, Sam Rayburn in the House representing this at the moment, or one could draw examples on the Senate side as well. And the leadership on the executive side I find appalling. It's ideological, and it's set by their own definition somehow in the 1920s, in which Coolidge prosperity, which led to Hoover Depression, is somehow deemed to be the golden age of the United States.
Don't you find this a little surprising, this attitude?
Well, I don't find it surprising from the people who are in power.
Yes, of course.
I guess I find it surprising that we have come to this state and the state of affairs, and I think that that state of affairs was brought on by a degree of overconfidence and incompetence on the part of the preceding administration, so that and while all that smacks of partisanship, and in part it is, because as an old line Democrat, I think that the Democratic Party over a couple of hundred years has offered solid, imaginative leadership. We, on both sides of the aisle, and including the last Democratic administration, while the commitments were exciting, the concepts, and the concepts too, that we were unable to translate this very effectively into national policy and programs that were up to the standard of, were up to meeting and coping with the problem set.
Well, that seems to be pretty clear. There just hasn't been national policy that people could get hold of.
And, of course, this harks back to things we said earlier, that the American people like
quick fixes. We've been used to frontiers that could be met and exploited. After all, it wasn't all American, quote, know-how and genius that put us where we are. We also happen to have to be located in a relatively isolated continent with tremendous resource base open to development and, unfortunately, exploitation. But we're running out.
That is one of the big problems. Well, we've been talking about public policy, really, about this Center for the Study of Public Policy and Administration.
I tried to roughly cover the IES situation. The other appointment, it sort of rounded out my participation in the interdisciplinary programs, was the invitation to succeed Clara Penniman as the director of the Center for Public Policy and Administration. This program, I regret to say, was not really born within the university, but rather in state government. When Wayne McGowan was Secretary of Administration for Warren Knowles, this was conceived. And, of course, with the university's approval, some monies were set up to create this center, which had both an instructional and potentially a research mission. The program offering, the degree offering, is a master's degree, and we've attracted good students, and they in turn, about half of them, have gone back into Wisconsin state government. Some to leave for other opportunities, and some to go to the state government, some to go to the federal government, some to local units of government. And the research program has never generated much support, though potentially it's there. But again, the strength of the operation is the fact that its executive committee and its faculty represents a multidisciplinary mix within the social studies. And it does not have, unlike urban and regional planning, it does not have departmental stakes. So that the young assistant professor is appointed with his academic home, shall we say, in political science. Young John Witte is an example, who is the grandson, by the way, of Edwin.
Oh.
Yale PhD, right, Wisconsin undergraduate, Yale PhD. But Witte is paid 50-50, half from the center and half from political science. The personnel management of Witte is essentially the responsibility of political science. His duties are split. And that's the pattern in the Institute. This, again, was by invitation on the part of the executive committee of the center. That I not forego or give up links with the other academic programs, but rather that I be the half-time director of the center. And I accepted this really with enthusiasm because it provided an opportunity to relate planning to the center, to keep the IES linkage, keep the law school linkage, all to the end that we bring faculty resources to bear on these young people that wanted to be trained for a professional career in government.
Mm-hmm.
So that in part by accident, obviously, but it was sort of a fulfillment of what I was all about in terms of being a member of the faculty. So it was a very, very happy circumstance. And we built up the enrollments, added first-rate faculty, and fortunately also in the process of losing a few, like Matthew Holden, who chose not to return to the University of Wisconsin.
Oh.
And he finished at the Energy Regulatory Commission. I'm not sure that he did the right thing, but he did. One other senior faculty is departing for, I think, extended life or extended duties in Israel.
Who is that?
Karkansky. First-rate scholar and teacher, Ira Karkansky. Clara Pellman will retire soon. I was obliged to retire, Bill Young will retire soon. So there will be some of a complete turnover on the senior faculty at the center. However, I think we are now, the center is well enough established with state government particularly, and reasonably well recognized within the university and administration, within the faculty of the administration, that it will in fact continue and prosper in years to come. Helping all of this is not just our own local commitment, but the fact that people like Derek Curtis Bach, the president of Harvard, is convinced that the great gap in American professional training is this very area. And Bach has really given the intellectual leadership and at Harvard the action leadership with respect to the Kennedy School. Bach was dean of the law school, the chairman of the planning and executive committee brought the Kennedy School to full flower.
Mm. I see.
And it's always been my maxim that if it's good enough for Harvard, it ought to be good enough for us at least to look at it rather seriously.
Reasonable position.
As a matter of fact, more so, given the traditions and history of the University of Wisconsin and its training of and its service to both the state and national governments. Well, we arranged a joint degree program with the law school, which is something that John Conway and I had always wanted to do. For our graduates, the law school reduces their graduation requirements and conversely on a proportional basis. We have 4 or 5 students a year pursuing that avenue. Then, looking at the future of all of that and what I wanted to accomplish, and it's very near accomplishment now, was to integrate urban and regional planning as a department and the Center for Public Policy and Administration and the graduate training program for foreign students that Bill Young has led for the past 10 years, and Ed Young is now involved in, as the third element in a school or a center, I don't really care what it's called, of public affairs.
Oh, yes.
Now the mix is not easy because each has its own history and its own status. Bill Young's program uses our degree, we have a degree authority. Urban Regional Planning, on the other hand, is a full-fledged department. So it would be a rather another umbrella organization. But a relatively benign umbrella kind of organization of managing and giving some collective strength to the to these three programs involved in a sense in the public sector, with a continuing appropriate linkages back into the disciplines with the business school, with the law school, IES, and other such activities. I think that's going to go. It isn't going to cost very much, and I think the Chancellor and the Academic Planning Council and all these people are prepared to do this and to give it some pizzazz and due recognition. We want to name this the Robert LaFollette School of Public Affairs.
Oh, I like that.
Here we have in our own ranks, our own graduate, our own political family, the person who really represented the application of intellect to public problems. And all we've done for LaFollette is to name one house in the dormitories for him. So what better, you see?
Yes, right.
If Minnesota can have the Humphrey School and Harvard the Kennedy School and Texas the Johnson School, why not go back to the real pioneer in this exercise, I say, of applying intellect to public problems and have a LaFollette School in Wisconsin?
I can't think of anything more appropriate.
So I think this is going to go, and I'm sorry that I didn't have the chance to see this all the way through, but I think it's going to happen. And I should, you know, be delighted when this all comes about.
How soon do you think this might develop?
Within the next year.
That soon?
Yeah, because the groundwork has been laid. And there are people in the legislature, unfortunately one was Harnish, who was leading, Tom Harnish, but there are others. For example, the Florida in the Assembly, Tom Loftus, is one of our graduates.
I see.
And this helps.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that whoever may be elected governor, whether it's Tony Earle or Wood or Schreiber or the Republican, who's really an extension professor on leave, you know, in trouble. Maybe you can plug their name in.
Yes, I can do that.
Will Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I would think would be most agreeable to all of this. And if it comes about, it will be a very real leg up, both within the campus or on the campus, and gaining some modest external recognition.
Would there be a degree program or PhD?
It could be, of course, but planning has PhD authority now.
Yes.
I'm rather inclined to think that this area, or let's say that this IES degree is generated, and maybe it won't be only an IES degree. Maybe it'll come out of there, the potential PhD program that kind of I talked about earlier, but have a broader base. It's conceivable it could be the center, IES, and so on. Again, you form the appropriate organizing base, make it not just an IES program. Or on a PhD program, I have not honestly pushed for this, because I thought that given the center's organizational format and participation, people jointly appointed that the degree programs, the PhD programs, can continue and simply be offered by political science, economics, sociology, the participating discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Taught in the first, when she was a graduate student in English, in the first integrated liberal studies effort, when Bob Pooley was
he was head of it.
Head of it, yes. And the professor of English, and we had a distinguished group of interdisciplinarians who were working in that freshman sophomore level program. She came from a century of Southern background, Memphis and other points in the South. She herself had grown up in the upper Midwest, but that was the family lineage and pattern. We had three children, Carlisle Ford, who was named for me and for his uncle, able young surgeon who was killed in the war on a naval vessel off Okinawa. Elizabeth Ruiz and Frederica. They have all now completed college, with Ford being the up-and-coming academic of the piece, who were at Chapel Hill and a Rhodes Scholar at New College and Oxford. Then back to Wisconsin for his PhD and the Dan Bromley in agricultural economics, and now back to Chapel Hill as a faculty member in political science. The girls are seeking employment.
They've got lots of company.
Yeah, which I hope will be successful soon. Elizabeth, their mother, died in 1964. It was a complex case of multiple sclerosis, or at least that was as close as the diagnosis could come, and then added complications and so on. I was remarried in 1966 to Eleanor Vilas, who had grown up in Madison, and her family was not of the distinguished William Freeman Vilas strain, but a set of distant relatives. Her mother, Madison family, the Johnson family, whose claim to fame was the development of the American Tool Company.
Oh.
Sally, as is known, has had two children by previous marriage. Michael, who is a graduate of the University of Colorado and the Wisconsin Law School, who is currently serving as a senior clerk out in the United States Court of Appeals on the West Coast. Served a year in San Francisco, and this year in Juneau, Alaska. That Ninth Circuit sweeps up all of the western states and Hawaii and Alaska.
Oh, my.
And then a daughter, Catherine, who is an equestrian of some talent and trains horses and gives instruction in dressage and all the elegant techniques of riding. So the family currently five children. That I've identified. Now, I don't know if there's anything further on that score that is appropriate for this purpose.
Well, I guess we've covered the territory fairly thoroughly.
We've probably exhausted the subject and bared most of which is appropriate for public scrutiny.
Well, am I correct in my feeling that looking back at you, you enjoyed your years at the University of Wisconsin?
Well, of course. I was never a great scholar. Maybe a fair teacher. And it's sort of interesting, at least in my case, I think one becomes a better teacher over the years as one accumulates experience. To relate to theoretical and book-achieved knowledge. So that in the latter years, in which someone like Steve Bourne, who'd been chief state planner and comes from a hard science background, a geologist, we offered, there were several years, a joint course of introduction to regional planning. We enjoyed it. I think the students enjoyed it and gained a great deal from it. But it was the kind of teaching that one couldn't have done 20 years before that. It would have had the same, or much of the same, intellectual substance, but it couldn't have been offered with the confidence that experience brings to any, an application brings to any theoretical construct. And I enjoyed my various administrative roles within the university, both for the sake of doing it and improving, and I hope the subset that you were responsible for, or at one point in the coordinating committee, it was the entire post-high school educational effort for the state. There's been great satisfaction in that kind of service, and I was fortunate. And this is one of the things that the University of Wisconsin allows. They allow people very much to shape their own career path. If you want leave, you get leave. And so I was in and out of the university and served, I think I said yesterday, at every level of government, from appointments at the local level to trying to serve the United Nations at the international level. So, again, when that experience comes back and is plowed back into the leadership of a program like graduate training in public policy and public administration, again, that combination of actual experience and a reasonable amount of theoretical training and exposure to multidisciplinary activities. This, of course, is what I found exciting. And there are not many, if any, academic institutions in the country that can afford that sort of career pattern. Maybe it will not be true, no longer can be true. Maybe we're under too tight financial strictures and tying people to rather specific assignments, and that I was around in an era, however, in which it was, for which I'm very fortunate. We have in UW-Madison, and UW-Madison is representative, I think, of the state
one of the most successful experiments in public higher education, in part due to the quality of the faculty, quality of the leadership over the years, and in part due to the quality of the body politic that is, if not understood with precision what we were about, sensed that we were about the right things, and over the years, and the very recent years, have provided rather generously for a small state, relatively small state, to support the maintenance of the institution. So, on balance, it's all been a very positive and happy experience. There is one aspect of the Center for Public Policy and Public Administration that I failed earlier to develop. That is the commitment and the sub-organization within the center for delivering, to please, university faculty talent to problems of state government. We formed this up and call up the Office of Governmental Studies, a very slender staff, but we had some outside money, both the Brittingham and Ford Foundation, to launch this effort. And it is nothing more nor less than a institutionalization of the Wisconsin idea. And we have a working group, university faculty, and state government agency representatives that develop an agenda annually of critical areas in which the state needs help. And we, in turn, on the university side, seek to obtain, with adequate lead time, faculty members and associated graduate students or senior research associates, faculty members who are prepared, willing, and of course able to address those problems. It, mind you, it is only one additional element in the whole chain of relationships that the university enjoys with state government and other organizations around the state. It's worked quite well, and as part of this major plan for the center, the school or center for public affairs, this would be put on a permanent basis and enough state money put under it so that it can continue to function. And it's just another example and articulation of the traditional concept of the Madison campus, the Madison faculty, supporting legitimate concerns of state government. And this goes back in our history, of course, to Van Hise, geologist president of the university in the LaFalla era, and through World War I, and carried forward by men like John R. Commons, Ed Whitty, and others of our applied social scientists who over the years have provided the scholarly input that state issues deserve but find difficult to obtain unless our own state university is prepared to provide them. So I thought that development was worthy of a particular note in the context of the Center for Public Policy.
Yes.
done. Participating with it.
Mm-hmm.
And leave the instructional program at the professional master's level. So I don't think it's essential and it's going to be counterproductive to attempt to mount the PhD program through the center as distinguished from doing it through the participating discipline. Certainly the kind of PhD program that I conceived of discussed in terms of IAS would be the sort of PhD program that would probably best serve the needs of a student interested in being high level governmental staff people.
Okay.
Both the breadth, the depth, and the rigor of new methodology.
Well, I'd be very interested in watching developments in this area.
I think this is where we go. I think the Chancellor believes in it. And I'm reasonably sure that the director, the current director, Dennis Giesing, and his executive committee will move this along.
Great. Well, now, do you want to talk about your experiences in Yugoslavia?
Yes, that is fitting here in this period. This invitation to serve as project manager came through the UNDP, the United Nations Development Program. And this program turns to substantive elements within the UN structure for help in this sort of thing. Plus the thrust of it was that UNIS laws were interested in having a team, international team, help them with environmental problems on the Adriatic coast. It's a long coast. Beautiful place. And the center of their tourism, which all the way from Dubrovnik in the south, where the African Americans tend to go, to all the other communities and their resorts and beaches and so forth, with the beach from the Italian border. All the way to the Albanian border. And there were several republics involved, Slovenia in the north, Croatia, which was a major coastline, Bosnia, which was just a sliver, and Montenegro. Well, I went over Yugoslavia on a preliminary survey group.
Was this a large group?
No, this was five or six of us. They made a reconnaissance of the area and its problem. Preliminary to our being there, there had been two earlier planning projects. One in the south, Adriatic, and one in the north. Again, UN sponsored. And this was to be the culminating study, appropriate recommendations to the Islamic government, particularly the Republic's concerns,
because Yugoslavia was substantially decentralized for a communist state. And that meant principally Croatia, because they have the longest coastline by far. We that earlier reconnaissance team that had a Polish architect who actually been responsible for the restoration of Warsaw. Very interesting person. And you had the earlier UN effort in Macedonia following the earthquakes sometime in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of it. I'm in trouble.
Well, we come back to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found this sort of an exciting potential interlude that after having been at Living Regional Planning for 2 years and accepted the appointment. And the way these projects operate is you have a local country, in this case, Yugoslavian administrative staff and substantive staff, and the international staff, the UN development staff, operates in association with the home country staff. There's a smaller core of people, and then if you bring in from time to time other expert talent is needed to supplement the UN staff. The experience is valuable to me, principally, to be involved in close association with the totalitarian state. Now that sounds extreme, because Yugoslavia, among the communist nations, is relatively benign and sophisticated.
Yeah.
But one should never underestimate the latent power and willingness to use it for political control. Before I got there, the Croatia had gone through the convulsions of having a younger element of leadership deposed by Tito, and his old wartime pals reestablished in power. Now, the niceties and complexities of all that are beyond this discussion, even if I did understand them, I'm not sure I do.
Yeah.
But suffice it to say that the woman economist who was premier of Croatia was deposed and returned to the university, but not to the podium, but to the custodial staff.
Oh, dear.
So the this is their style of control, but equally effective to the more rigorous style that the Soviets employ. Well, I got over there in the fall of the year of the oil crisis, which was in 72, 74.
Right there, yes.
Yugoslavia has no oil. And like all of the Western European countries, dependent on the Middle East, and just being racked financially by meeting the program costs. So they have a fairly favorable relationship with Libya, which provides a good share of the Yugoslavian oil products or petroleum. The matter of organizing or dealing with the local staff and trying to interrelate an international staff is most of it. I had as a principle in the UN system that the Romanian plan, very evil, but the Yugoslavs really weren't about to take any contrary advice from a Romanian, particularly one with a German background, because some part of the Romanian intellectual class go back to early eastward migrations of German people. It was extremely difficult. The minister that we were responsible to in the Croatian government was most ambitious and more concerned with building a deep draft oil port in his own political base around Rijeka than he was in environmental quality of the sea. On the other hand, we had as a chief scientist a Yugoslav of great competence. But again, with that nice invitation of running conflict between the scientific and technical people who really knew what to do, but to a great extent, given the physical features of the Israeli coast, to gain any real acceptance of these technical reforms and technical improvements, to make any progress, for me to make very much progress with a communist bureaucracy that was facing, for the first time, because there were great difficulties after the war, but it was a first setback period in the Yugoslav economy, and caused in part of the end of this oil.
So we're back to the oil crunch.
Back to the oil crunch. And while they were willing a new construction and so on, to install proper pollution abatement equipment, they found it very difficult, and understandably so, to face the notion of retrofitting these communities up and down the Adriatic coast. If you think the problems of mixed storm and sanitary sewers in a city like Milwaukee in the United States are difficult, fancy a situation in communities of some reasonable size, 10 or 20,000, that simply have no systems at all. The system is gradient, it runs downhill to the sea. And they had just really finished a very expensive fresh water supply system up and down the coast, which they never had.
What did they do? Was it
on local wells? Systems and this sort of thing. So to that extent, of course, the country was underdeveloped. On the other hand, it really wasn't underdeveloped in the sense of their style of governmental structure, nor on the scientific and technical side. Particularly the Slovenians and Croatians are very advanced people. After all, there's a major university of Zagreb and related scientific institutes, and so on. So that the you are not really dealing with an underdeveloped people in which you had only a handful of intellectuals.
Well, in this case, then, why did they want a UN group?
Prestige and the support, but not really committed to taking their advice, or whatever it was.
That's what I was beginning to wonder.
But complicated, made much more difficult for them, by the internal, the just past internal political discontent and problems in Croatia, and again this matter of money. Well, I was ill while I was over there in the hospital for a time and so on, and I concluded that I simply would pick up the option of leaving after 1 year rather than attempting to carry this forward. And because at best, given all the problems which were of no one's making, the economic problems which were not of their own making, obviously, but the fact that there was a rather sophisticated disinterest on the part of the government in Zagreb, the Croatian government, led me to conclude that this was a relatively futile effort, someday perhaps, but nothing much would come of it in short order. So I left after 1 year, but had gained made some contribution to problem resolution. Personally, a very, at times unpleasant, but nonetheless valuable lesson of dealing with a communist bureaucracy. Of course, we enjoyed the people and the common people in this magnificent mountain country. At least where we were on the coast. Mm-hmm. The intellectuals were difficult, very arrogant, very sensitive, and completely dominated, in fact, by the governmental bureaucracy, which was a bad mix, which to attempt to cope.
Sounds it. Do you feel any progress was made during that time?
Oh, I think so. Some of the base studies and some of the policies pointing towards degrees of resolution and participation by the local governmental units, the communes, in setting higher standards, the legislation at the regional, at the republic level. And of course, the legislation is written in a sort of bold rhetorical terms and so on. But of course, that doesn't mean very much unless there are resources and the will to follow it up in terms of action program. So yes, I think there was some progress made earlier, and there was some modest progress made under this operation. But in many respects, and I'm sure that our reconnaissance group and the people who preceded us looking at this didn't have an adequate fix, didn't have an adequate appreciation of how expensive and difficult it would be to retrofit or fit at all, in engineering terms, the communes and communities up and down the coastline. And of course, the question is to weighting of the levels of pollution. The waters themselves do move. The upper end of the Adriatic is kind of like Lake Michigan, turning around on itself. But if the population isn't too great and the the level of pollutants being introduced isn't too great, and in fact treat new industry and new hotels and touristic enterprises, they may be able to get along. And then there's first of all another problem, and that's the Italian side. After all, they're only on one side of the Adriatic.
True.
But you have North Italy's industry pouring its waste down the Po into the other side of the Adriatic. And it's just almost impossible to imagine that the Italian government, pressured by left-wing unions on one side and avaricious industrialists on the other, will ever put together adequate programs to try to deal with the Italian waste. So, again, one of these nettlesome, difficult problems with not just the national dimension, but an international dimension.
Mm-hmm.
In some respects, there is an encouraging sign, if anything comes of it. The United Nations Environmental Program, decided to develop after the Stockholm Conference, is supporting a Mediterranean pollution abatement program. I suppose if I said that the Italian-Yugoslavian relationship is difficult, imagine bringing in all the rest of them around the Mediterranean. But it's conceivable, I suppose, if you raise the level what on the face of it would appear to be a ridiculous level, you could get some common understanding, at least, on both the continental side and the African side, of what may have to be done. And Stephen Ketchkes, who's our chief scientist, whom I spoke well, is the director now of that Mediterranean effort. Well, I obviously wish him well.
That presumes a degree of cooperation
that
doesn't exist right now.
Now, let's see, we... I kind of think that there was some outside association. I did mention the Lucy Land Use Governor Study, didn't I?
Yes.
And
yes,
that legislation that came out of that group failed.
Oh, it did.
It failed. I think that our dedicated environmentalists, one thing that they fail to understand is the sensitivity of the average land owner to governmental strictures and controls. Not alone are you touching the very center sometimes in the farm community of their existence and their economic existence, you're touching a very sensitive chord in the social makeup of America. Well, why did most of our forebears come here? If it was for cheap land to be owned not in some sort of quasi-feudal term, but in fee simple. Period. And with no overriding easements or strictures on the part of government at any level. So when you're in this kind of sensitive area, the political process and response is most apprehensive. And you can see that recent response, and whether it's wetlands legislation, whether it's the problem of the state buying lands for this very state forest that you're
where we are right
living
now.
Within. Mm-hmm. Just went through this on a 40-acre site up the river in which the town board was adamant that on this issue, and that PNR should not buy any further lands. Issue carried to the governor, who must release on all of these land purchases. He approved the DNR purchase. But that hasn't changed the mind or feelings or attitudes of the local town board and any of the local citizens. So, this is the most sensitive area. And in part, I was talking earlier about carrying over to the action side of planning and public policy in the environmental area and the land area and so on, are things that one acquires and learns historically and also by being involved in real property law.
Mm-hmm.
We are creatures to a degree, even to a substantial degree, of our past. And if we wish to make fundamental changes, or even those that appear to be fundamental changes, we have to be well grounded and be prepared to cope.
Mm-hmm. You have to work within the existing legal structure, I suppose.
Yes. And within the mores and traditions of your society. I remember Alistair Cook's program, remember the historical series on the United States?
Yes.
He was in the period of the French and Indian Wars and said that the first of all, British with colonial help, British regulars in the colonial militia won that war and drove the French out of North America. The post-war developments infuriated the colonists because the British were attempting to seal off everything west of the Appalachians as a great preserve for the Indians and fur traders.
Mm-hmm.
And Cook put it, the militiamen from Pennsylvania and New York and Massachusetts and Virginia had been out fighting in the Ohio Valley. They had seen their future only to have it denied.
Of course they
Well, let's cut off.
I think I'd like to go back a little bit. You talked about your activities on the political scene at the river in Washington. I understand that you, on the local scene, were also active on Durham. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what you did.
I think we can approach it chronologically. After I returned from Washington, I was relatively inactive for several years because of following the death of my wife and concern with the immediate family. I wasn't venturing forth very much in public affairs unless I was obliged to by my job. But this was the Lucy era coming on in state government, and I had no particular role in the Lucy administration except to consult informally with the Department of Planning. And I did have that staff relationship with the land use study, but that was about the extent. when I wasn't involved directly in the party process. But as the years went along, I became more involved, and particularly at the national or the presidential politics level, because of my friendship and interest in the career of Senator Jackson of Washington. I had first met Jackson when I was stationed in Washington, D.C., serving in Washington, D.C. He was, for a short period, chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And his Senate interests corresponded with mine. He has had two general areas of interest by many, and I think that's evidenced by the fact that his presidential efforts came to naught. But like Lyndon Johnson before him, I had a high regard for people of long experience in the Congress who are effective.
In what way is he misunderstood?
Well, if not misunderstood, they disagreed with. But I say misunderstood because he is not the fire eater or the warmonger that he is pictured by any within the Democratic Party, but rather has no illusions about the Soviets and wants to drive hard agreements and understandings with them. On the arms control area, his position has been consistently that to enter into treaties that simply agreed or even higher and higher, limits, if you can call them that, on nuclear armament is preposterous. That what we must be seeking is to redress and reduce the level of nuclear armament. And before all of this rise, both the United States and the Soviet Union into permanent bankruptcy. the expenditures in this area are outlandish, of course. And the bigger it all gets, potentially the more dangerous it all gets. And I won't go into all of that. He is a tough anti-Soviet voice, but also truly a believer in arms control and limitations, delimitations and reductions. On the domestic side, of course, he is in many respects, both in a historical sense and a working sense, the last of the New Dealers. And his work as chairman of the Senate Interior Committee was genuinely distinguished. His one major piece of legislation, or a major piece of legislation that was enacted, was the Environmental Policy Act. And this is the process under which the environmental impact statements are required and accomplished concerning all major governmental programs and projects.
Something I consider a very good step.
Very, very sound, and a very... it's had profound effect on setting aside or modifying or eliminating projects before they become fait accompli, only to have to go back again and try to undo what has been done. He sponsored, I think, three times the National Land Use Planning Legislation, which was not a federal, not a set of federal proscriptions, but rather would have provided, under national guidance, substantial monies to the several states to do a comprehensive land use planning operation by way of guiding and controlling urban development major infrastructure, roads, bridges, highways, and so on, the location of airports, and key industrial locations. The, in some respects, the most ambitious planning, national planning effort since the National Resources Planning Board is the New Deal.
Now, is this state by state plan, or does it have regional aspects?
Well, it was state by state. It did not have regional aspects, though that might have developed. And he was using what in fact we had in place, and it was state by state, but with federal overview and federal support. Another example of, I think, of imaginative federalism, but the emphasis was on state planning rather than on national planning as such, with national support. It passed the Senate 3 times and failed 3 times in the House. But it's an example of Jackson's long-term commitment to addressing these complex national issues through a reasonable intellectual process.
Hmm.
Well, when he ran in 72, I was modestly active, but in 76, I was most active, and ended up, of course, campaigning to the extent that I could around the state and around the Madison area, and helping him in where I could, in Milwaukee and other places. And then standing for selection as a delegate. And so in 76, I was a Jackson delegate at the convention in New York. Not many of us, but by this time he had withdrawn formally, and most of the votes went to Carter, but it was good fun to at least to stand to the end in support of Jackson, because I thought he was clearly superior in terms of experience, general competence, and dedication to the kind of program that I was concerned about, and therefore believe that he should have been the nominee. Well, obviously he wasn't. Still in the Senate and up for re-election this year in the state of Washington, where he seems to do exceedingly well. He runs almost as well as Proxmire does in Wisconsin. This is not to suggest that there's any similarity, except for their successful re-election efforts in their home states. Well, that was my principal political activity, but of course that sort of thing involves you with, to a certain extent, with state party leadership, to some extent with local Democrats, and always makes for a lively and interesting set of relationships and dialogue with people at the Washington level.
Mm-hmm.
And given my other assignments, of course, in the university, I was in and out of Washington over that period of years, dealing with agencies on the university business, and being involved politically with Jackson and friends at the old Washington friends and colleagues in the Defense Department on a personal political basis.
But you didn't get involved in any additional activity on a national level. I was wondering, because of your friendship with Johnson, for instance, whether you might have been
No, I wasn't, because the well, the Johnson era was over in 68, and the last couple of years of that were so fraught with the turmoil of the war that and my own personal circumstances in Wisconsin that I never really pursued or developed any closer or further working association with the Johnson administration. Mentioning of the war, I think I should say that at home, in the troubled days on the campus, that I worked very closely with Ed Young, who had become chancellor, and was his informal liaison with the Wisconsin National Guard when it was called to duty on the campus. You recall that occurred twice.
Yes, yes, I do. What did this involve?
Well, what it involved was being the bridging, the working link between the Guard commander and staff and the university administration. And to some extent, of course, it involved the local sheriff and police too. But the local sheriff and police, particularly the police, were already pretty well integrated with the university staff. But it was the National Guard that was a new element. Well, having been in the 32nd Division for all that time, I knew the commanders and the senior staff officers of the task force that came into Madison. It was Brigadier General Staling, who was the commander, an old associate in Beaver Dam. And the Wisconsin Guard, in my judgment, performed exceedingly well. They were here twice, and there were no deaths and no serious incidents or injuries.
Well, I think people were nervous having the Kent State example in front of them.
And it happens to be an example, may I suggest, of the difference in quality of one state and another in the National Guard. Now, you can't write it off fully to that. But Staling, who came to command our troops in Madison, was an experienced combat soldier. And with the division of the South Pacific, had risen through the ranks to be a general over the post-war years. Had had four children, I think, who were graduates of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So he didn't come in to the scene as a complete outsider. Now, this was successful, he's an engineer with the Crick Foundry in Beaver Dam, successful in his private life, excellent soldier, and a person as a father who understood the attitudes and concerns of young people. And this was reflected in the way he operated the presence of the guardsmen.
Can you give any specific situations?
I don't know that I can, really, except that his troops handled themselves well. They were well-disciplined, they were effective, and they were courteous. And there was none of the tough in the sense of doing their job, but they weren't out looking for trouble.
I see.
And there's a subtle difference by the behavior of soldiers, well recognizing that they were dealing with their own contemporaries. Maybe they're more fortunate contemporaries in many cases, who were students in Madison. Well, they were not themselves college students, though some of them had been. some of them became college students further down the road. But I think it was that sort of intangible attitude of a constructive nature of the job to be done with decency and fairness and courtesy that stemmed from Staling himself.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any particular problems stemming from your week-long profession?
Well, sure. Unpopularity with some of my colleagues who, of course, had me marked up for years as essentially a military type, and this is exactly what they expected me to be involved in this tough guy stance. But and I suppose they were no more critical of me than they were of other senior officers of the university, including the chancellor. I think Ed Young was a remarkable chancellor. That New England firmness came through, and he wasn't about to allow the institution to be closed down. And to protect the faculty and students who, in fact, were interested in pursuing their normal and appropriate business. So I have a very personal and professional regard for Ed as a as the leader of this campus.
Well, these qualities stood him in good stead, and he was certainly more successful in the situation than Bill Sewell was.
Yes. I never knew Bill that well, and so I didn't really know enough about what went on, except from observation and from reading the press in the earlier earlier affrays. But I think just by the difference in their personalities. Would suggest, I think, that it was very difficult for Sewell, who is a quiet, introspective, scholarly person, not without humor and sophistication, but nonetheless, it wasn't the kind of setting that Sewell found, found compatible with his own capacities. And this is not to be critical of him, but rather to say that Young had the capacities to cope with a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm. He seems to have, and perhaps someone should allow credit to Bill Sewell for perhaps recognizing his own limitations and
from
resigning.
Of course.
Before we completely leave the National Guard, this is going back quite a ways. I noted that you were present at an atomic test or tests in Nevada way back in the 50s. And was this part of your National Guard experience?
Yes, it was. And it's part of the training for senior officers that was available. As I recall, not required, but it was a short week's training activity that I was interested in taking part in. This was when the Defense Department was running a series of tests and demonstrations at Yucca Flats up north of Las Vegas in that desert testing area. Well, we spent give or take a week out there of instruction on atomic weaponry,
This is a routine part of your training or whatever?
It was part of that special little unit of training. I suppose that in the Wisconsin Guard there were probably 10 or 15 of us over a period of time had that training. And so there was instruction in the science and technology of nuclear weapons and some on their use, tactical, strategic and tactical use. Tactical more for us because we were army troops. and waiting for the weather to abate so that the flight could be made. And it was. We were out there in trenches as observers of the bombing and the detonation and the effects. This is very forbidding. It's not a great large weapon, but certainly is large or bigger than the weapons I think that were used in Japan. It's the sort of thing that was important to us as senior officers in any military organization that might at some time have to come up against all of this. In political in civic terms, it was an ugly lesson in the vast power and devastation that can be achieved through the use of nuclear weapons. And as I say, these are relatively small compared to the sort of thing that both the Soviets and the United States are now prepared to dump on one another if it all comes to that. So it at the time was I wanted to do this and I did it as a part of my training as a senior officer in the Army Reserve components. But in retrospect, as I say, a forbidding kind of experience which bolsters one's understanding of the utter devastation that can be brought about if through some mischance or if through deliberate action either the one or one of the nuclear powers opens up this kind of warfare.
In light of the destructive power of just a single one of these, it does seem a little needless for a country to go on manufacturing so many of them. Why do we need that kind of deterrent capability?
This is an issue that's well beyond our capacity to try to deal with in this session, except as I observed earlier, I have been extremely concerned about these understandings that lead only to greater production and stockpiling of weapons and weapon systems in this competitive race with the Soviets, and that one could only hope that somehow we can reach an understanding, some understandings in which the total capacity is reduced and the remaining capacity is fixed at such a negotiated level of reciprocal terror that we can continue to have some confidence that neither side will take the initiative. So far, how many years since the end of the war, we've managed to do it. But my concern is that if we do not maintain parity, and I'm suggesting parity at a reduced level, and with not proliferating these weapons to every banana revolution republic, if I can be old-fashioned, so that they can start something. If this is what we should be attempting to achieve, that if we allow to set these limits higher and higher, and one side or the other takes advantage of that to build up to that limit and the other doesn't, you generate this instability in the relationship, and there lies the greatest risk.
So we just go on hoping.
And working.
And working. Well, now maybe we should turn to some of your more personal activities. I know that you retired just about a year ago, and what you have been doing and what your plans are for this period of time.
we decided to move out of Madison, and while I miss particularly the university community, Madison itself is growing to be rather large and sort of frivolous in its behavior.
What brought you as far north as Greer?
Well, really, you know, I grew up mid-state in the Green Bay area, but my mother's family operated sawmill, timber mills in the Oneida County area, turn of the century, until the Depression. I camped as a boy on the Wolf, and when I was assistant United States attorney, I came into this northwest corner of the state, because we would hold court up here in Spirit, and a lot of our business was with the Indian tribes because we had exclusive jurisdiction. So I moved around occasionally between Bayfield and Lac des Flambeaux and Hayward and Superior, so that I got to know and appreciate the northwestern corner, and knew that the Brule, this river valley, was sort of the last best thing in the state. So when the opportunity came to buy a parcel, and we did about 12 years ago now, and we decided that we didn't want to give it up, and we couldn't afford to maintain both places, and so we decided we'd move here. We have, and added on to the place, and we have a 40-acre land base. And growing up in a small town, it doesn't trouble me to live in a hamlet like Brule, live in the country. And in addition to all of that, we're set over here, really very close to a metropolitan area. We're only 35 miles from Superior, Duluth one way, and Ashland the other. So you can sort of have urban life and services to the extent that you want or need them, but still live in isolation in this magnificent valley. We've been active since we've been here. I'm a rural river sportsman, and I was one of the leaders of the legislative fight to ban inner tubing on the river, which was successful. I served on the board of trustees over at Little Northland College, and which is an interesting contrast to being a part of the mega complex of Madison to a little liberal arts environmental college with 700 students.
That is small.
To share in its trials and tribulations and rather imaginative programming. So there's and we've tied on modestly to local democratic politics, so that the life is pleasant and stimulating. It is not complete isolation, and though Madison, Milwaukee are not easy to get to, particularly with the current schedules and costs of air travel, I did participate this past year in one conference in Milwaukee on water-related matters, and a symposium offered by the Center for Public Policy in the state for a selected group of participants early in the summer. So, here we are, and we enjoy it, and I think that our decision is right, and we're finding life here very pleasant.
Well, it certainly seems so, from my observation. Do you have anything you want to say about your family?
I think I indicated earlier that maybe I didn't, but anyway, my first wife was Elizabeth Eshelman, who was a UW graduate and taught in the first, I think he was a graduate student.